everyone. I'm Mary Texera, and I am a recent retiree from the Department of Sociology here at Cal State San Bernardino. And we are offering one more episode in our ongoing series on race and policing. And today we have a very, very intriguing conversation, and I think you'll like the title. It is about police deception and the logic of police deception, you know, which is the second part is even more intriguing. Yeah. So I am not going to take up a lot of time to wax poetic about what we're going to talk about, because he will talk about this in a few minutes. But I do want to thank several entities who have allowed us I think we're ending our third year now with this conversation since the death of George Floyd. So we certainly have to thank the sociology, or excuse me, I've got sociology on the brain, Social and Behavioral Sciences, College of Social and Behavioral Sciences. We also want to thank the FOW Library, and Robbie is a fine example of what's going on at the FOW Library, and very, very supportive. We also want to thank the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee that has been in operation now for, you know, going on probably 30 years at Cal State. So, and then last but really not least, the IT department at Cal State, Finley being our go-to guy in terms of keeping us talking and keeping those airways open. Airwaves open, I'm sorry. So without any delay, I will turn it over to my colleague, Matt, who will introduce himself as well as give us our land acknowledgement.
Thank you, Mary. Mm-hmm. My name is Matt Patino. I am an adjunct instructor of history at Crafton Hills College. I am also a former police officer with the city of Rialto in California. We recognize that California State University San Bernardino sits on the territory and ancestral land of the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians, the Yuhaviatam. We recognize that every member of the California State University San Bernardino community has benefited and continues to benefit from the use and occupation of this land since the institution's founding in 1965. Consistent with our values of community and diversity, we have a responsibility to acknowledge and make visible the university's relationship to Native peoples. By offering this land acknowledgement, we affirm Indigenous sovereignty and will work to hold California State University San Bernardino more accountable to the needs of American Indian and Indigenous peoples. And now I'll turn it over to Robbie Madrigal.
Hi, my name is Robbie Madrigal. I'm really excited about today's guest. I'm from the FOW Library. I'm one of the organizers of the program, and I'll turn it over to Mike German.
Thanks, Robbie. I'm Mike German. I'm a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School and a former FBI special agent. It's my pleasure today to introduce another former FBI special agent, Luke William Hunt, who's the author of Police Deception and Dishonesty, The Logic of Lying. We didn't serve together in the FBI, but we have friends in common. And I'm particularly interested in this book because as an FBI undercover agent, it was involved in a lot of the practice of deception. So I'm really excited to have Luke here. After graduating from the University of Tennessee Law School, Luke was a law clerk for a federal judge in Virginia, and then joined the FBI as a special agent, where he served in Virginia and Washington, D.C. He did his doctoral work in philosophy at the University of Virginia. Luke is now an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Alabama, where he teaches in the department's jurisprudence track. He's the author, in addition to the book we'll be discussing today, he's also the author of The Retrieval of Liberalism in Policing and The Policing Identity Crisis, Terrier Warrior Guardian. So quite accomplished scholar. Luke, really happy to have you here. Please tell us about your new book.
Thank you very much for that introduction. It's such a pleasure to be with you all. Before I jump into it, I'm just going to share my screen really quickly. I think It's been a while, but I think I know how to do that. Okay, hold on. Let's see here. And then get the slideshow. Okay. Okay, are we good? Everyone seeing the slide? Okay, great. And if you all are listening to this as a podcast, I know some people will, don't worry, you're not missing much from the slides. They're not anything particularly special. But let me say a little bit about my background before I jump into it. I know there's some students that are listening and you might find some of this interesting or helpful. So as Mike mentioned, I was an FBI agent before making the completely natural and extremely lucrative career change to philosopher, right? So now I'm a philosopher. So you might think, well, that's a very sort of unusual path. So how did that happen? Well, when I was in college, like I'm sure a lot of you all listening are in college now, I tried to figure out what I wanted to do in my life. The FBI seemed really interesting, public service, exciting. So I said, well, what do I have to do to be an FBI agent? Law school seemed like the easiest choice. That sounds strange, but that's really the only reason I went to law school is because I wanted to be an FBI agent. So I did that. After law school, I clerked with a federal judge. And during that year of my clerkship, I was going through the application to get to Quantico. And I got in pretty much right after the clerkship ended. So in the FBI, I was there for 7 years. I did 3 years in Charlottesville, Virginia, the resident agency, as it's called there. And as a new agent in a very small office, you pretty much do whatever comes in the door. Bank robberies, crimes against children, some white collar stuff, drugs, gangs, a little bit of everything. And then they rotated me to Washington, D.C., where I was on a corruption squad, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, FCPA. And that's basically investigating U.S. persons or corporations who bribe foreign governments for business contracts, much different than my work in Charlottesville. And then I ended my career in the Bureau with a year at headquarters in a supervisory position. So after 7 years, I decided to leave. A lot of people ask why I decided to leave. And it's, I guess, in some ways, a complicated answer, but maybe it's not as complicated I'm making it out to be. So first of all, there is certainly a sense in which I had always thought about being an academic, and I had this in the back of my mind. I was studying for graduate exams while I was trying to get into Quantico as a close plan B. The second thing that happened sort of 7 years into my career, I started a family, and, you know, hopping around to Europe on a moment's notice was not always conducive to having a family. And then the third thing, I guess, which might be the most interesting today, is that, you know, some of the things I did in the FBI or had to do in the FBI and were just not particularly things that I found enjoyable, or I found them difficult, or I had issues with them. So Mike can certainly attest to this, but one thing FBI agents have to do is they have to handle informants. And I was often uncomfortable with sort of the dynamics of those relationships. And I'll talk a little bit about some examples of that today. And the tremendous amount of power that the government has to wield over citizens and members of society. And then the other thing, I guess, more broadly, you know, an FBI agent measures their career success, I think, at least objectively speaking, through statistics, like a lot of police officers do, right? And we had, I forget the name of the form, I think it had a five in it, but we had a statistic form, and the statistic that was most important was getting a federal indictment. And to be sure, I felt like when I got an indictment, sometimes justice was being done. On the other hand, you know, a success for me was this sort of devastation in the lives of others, right? And sometimes, again, we know they're victims and some people deserve to have punishment. But it was very difficult for me to measure my success through this sort of chaos and destruction that was being wielded on people, even those who broke crimes, because I think one reason for that was that I kind of viewed myself as someone who, but for a few, you know, twists and turns in life, I could have ended up on the other side of this. And so some of the tactics we used and some of the power we wielded troubled me. And I ultimately said, you know what, I'm going to, it's now or never, I'm going to go do something different. I left the FBI, got a fellowship to UVA to do my doctoral work, and been in academia since. So the talk I'm going to give today is about deception and dishonesty, as we've mentioned. And it might be frustrating to some of you all because rather than coming from this, from the perspective of the social sciences, which I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with, I'm coming from at this from sort of a philosophical perspective, but hopefully you'll find the conversation useful in some way. So let me do this. Let me start with a case study. I know our panelists are probably familiar with, or I know they're familiar with this, but maybe some of you out there are not. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Central Park 5 case very briefly because it's such a well-known case. And if you're not familiar with this case, a young woman was jogging in Manhattan Central Park, found near death, and this was back in 1989. The woman had been brutally beaten, raped, and she could not remember the attack when she was able to communicate several weeks later. However, in the interim, 5 teenagers confessed to the police in the days after the crime. The boys were aged 14 to 16, and they'd been in the park with a larger group of young people who had been harassing other park goers. So by the time that the teenagers had given confessions, they'd been in custody and interrogated by the police for 14 to 30 hours. And this is where I think it gets particularly important. They were told individually that the others had implicated them in the crime. And of course, we know that this was not true. And then more to the point, the police in the Central Park 5 case also claimed to have physical evidence, right? So things like fingerprints that could link the teenagers to the crime. So when one of the teenagers, for example, denied being in the park on the night of the crime, the detective said, well, I know you're there, or I know you were there, because we have fingerprint evidence on the woman's underwear. So this was, of course, a blatant lie. There was no fingerprint evidence of the teenager or fingerprint evidence at all on the clothing. But upon hearing this supposedly damning evidence, the teenager changed his story and said he took part in the attack on the woman. Ultimately, all 5 were convicted and incarcerated. And we now know, of course, from this case that the teenagers did not do this and that a rapist was free to continue to violate after the teen's convictions. So what I want to do to frame this case is I want to suggest that what the police did in that case, lying about very material facets of the case, both in terms of evidence, the legal situation they were in, perhaps they could go home if they just talked, rises to what I would describe as a level of fraud. And so I focus in my book on these instances of deception and dishonesty that are what I would describe as fraudulent in nature. So what we talk about when we talk about force and fraud, so one thing that I think is interesting, and I hope you find this interesting as well, is that I think force and fraud are in some sense related, and that both can be justified in emergency situations. So I know a lot of you are familiar with this, but let me just use the example of force briefly here, the legal justification of even deadly force, right? So a lot of you know, if we're going to start with an analysis, we see all these cases on television that seem horrific, and the police, not only are they not convicted, oftentimes they're not even charged when you have a deadly shooting that seems just so unjustified. Now, why is that? Well, if you look at the Constitution, specifically the Fourth Amendment, the Fourth Amendment makes it clear that we're not subject to unreasonable searches and seizures. And you might ask, well, how is that relevant to deadly force? Well, when the police shoot someone, and certainly when they shoot someone and kill someone, that person has most definitely been seized. So the analysis is whether that seizure is reasonable or unreasonable. Now, of course, we look at the Supreme Court to interpret whether it's reasonable or not. And in cases like Graham v. Connor, the court has construed reasonableness in a pretty broad way. Police act reasonably based on their actions in the moment, on the scene, in the midst of the sort of chaos, not, say, from our 2020 hindsight, evaluating the police as what the court might say, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking or something like that. The worry I have with that standard is that it fails to consider the moments, the minutes, the hours leading up to the encounter and whether there were bad tactics that led to that use of force. All right, so that's force, right? And we have this relatively robust standard for when we say force is justified or not. Now let's shift gears and talk about deception and dishonesty. So when is that justified and when is it not? Well, generally speaking, outside of policing, it's okay to engage in deception and dishonesty. I could lie to my students, I could lie to you, I'm not gonna go to prison for that. However, when deception and dishonesty crosses a line and it becomes fraudulent, right? For example, you can imagine a contractual setting based on that involves some kind of fraud. That certainly does rise to legal prohibitions. And yet, I've already alluded to this, as we'll see, the police engage in tactics that I think it's uncontroversially, in my view, rise to what we would describe as fraud. These material misrepresentations of fact and law that affect people's decision to speak, to make various choices for themselves. So this seems morally wrong. And so there should be a high bar for the police to use deception and dishonesty on par with fraud. And the way I want to approach this analysis is to think about it in terms of the norms of bargaining, right? So we can think of the social contract and a breach, a fraudulent breach of the social contract. We can also think about a breach of a concrete encounter, person to officer, in which the norms of bargains and bargain relationships are breached. So social contract, I'm not going to spend time on this. It's kind of philosophy 101 stuff, and I won't bore you with it. But the basic idea here is simply that the state, institutions of the state, like the police, they have legitimacy to the extent that they have authority to act. And you have authority through things like consent. We have this idea of policing by consent, which sort of govern the respective reciprocal rights and duties of the state and its citizens. Now, when the state breaches sort of idea of the social contract by acting fraudulently, the state lacks authority and its actions are illegitimate. So maybe a quick example here. I was in class this morning teaching a seminar on legal and philosophical problems in policing. And the policing strategy of broken windows came up. And I'm sure some people are familiar with that. It's probably taught by some of you. And I'm not an expert on this, but the rough idea, put it very crudely, is that areas that, you know, have these sort of low-level criminal offenses, broken windows, graffiti, and so on, create an environment of the perception of disorder. And so by addressing these sort of lower-level kinds of violations, we can sort of enhance this idea of order, and it sort of addresses criminality in a particular location. That's putting it very crudely. Now, an example of how this occurred, and I think it's somewhat controversial here. So think about surveillance and racial profiling. A good example is maybe New York City in the 90s, early 2000s under Mayor Giuliani. So you can put to good use this idea of broken windows, but what are the mechanisms that it's carried out? Well, think about stop and frisk. So stop and frisk, you know, if you see someone on the street, you stop them briefly, not a full-on detention, you pat them down for weapons. The Supreme Court has held that that's legal. It's not unreasonable, but it's based on a very specific standard. You have to have reasonable suspicion of criminality, right? So that's legal. If it's legal, strictly speaking, how might we construe that as wrong? Well, obviously, I think routinely stopping and frisking community members based on sort of discretionary authority that's contrary to, say, criminality, but rather based on bias, ethnicity, race, and so on, is a perversion of discretion. And it's a breach of that contract. It's not acting according to the rule of law. It's acting under color of law or the pretense of law. And so I think that's an example of legality that's merged into immorality based on abuse of discretion that undermines the social contract. Now, one final case study here, and then I'm going to move towards Q&A very quickly, because I think this idea of, you know, a breach of the social contract, defrauding people under the social contract, is a little bit high level abstract. So let's think about a very concrete encounter, another example that's closer to the Central Park Five. So in this particular case that I've got, it's called Alexander D'Angelo, if you can't see the slide. The police have a woman who they have evidence suggesting that she committed a crime, namely a drug crime. She had evidence of using, selling drugs. And so that gave the police leverage over the woman, right? So the police said, look, we've got this evidence, you committed a crime. You're facing 40 years in prison. You have a couple of options here. You know, it's your choice. You can test your luck at trial and, you know, probably be convicted given this evidence we have and spend 40 years in prison. Or alternatively, you can come work for us as an informant, a police informant, a drug informant, or just an informant generally. And in this particular case, here's what the police wanted the woman to do. They said, look, we're looking at this other guy for some various crimes, and we think you can get us some evidence on him. We want you to go engage in a sexual act with this guy for money, in other words, an act of prostitution, so we can charge him with prostitution and get him for the stuff we really want to get him on. So the police give this woman a wire recording device to record the sex act, and they give her a napkin to collect physical evidence of the sex act to hold against the person. Okay, so the woman does this, and ultimately, she ultimately learns that in fact she was not facing a 40-year prison sentence. She was facing a 6-year prison sentence. So the agreement for this woman to go through with this act, which arguably is an affront to human dignity, is based, in my view, on a very straightforward fraud, a misrepresentation of the bargain and exchange relationship. Now, of course, the court held that this was okay. There's no wrongdoing. I won't go into the legal analysis, but I think this is good evidence, at least from a moral perspective, of why these kinds of deception and dishonesty are unjustified. Now, last thing I'm going to say here is an objection, or not the last thing, but almost the last thing. And you might say something like this. Look, you know, criminals breach their end of the social contract. People breach their end of the social contract. So likewise, shouldn't the police be able to use deception and dishonesty to enforce the law against criminals? Well, maybe in some cases, I won't go into the cases I think is justified, but we need to think about, and at least in my view, the unjustified distribution of force and fraud, or especially fraud. So when we think about policing, we're usually thinking about the role the police are supposed to play in society, law enforcement, order maintenance, peacekeeping, and so on. But we should also think about the ways the police distribute both the benefits and the burdens of those roles. Do some communities, for example, reap more of the benefits of policing, while others must contend with more of the burdens? So the burdens would include being subjected to deception and dishonesty on par with fraud, might be in the form of extensive undercover operations, drug cases, and so on. It might be in the form of deceptive and dishonest interrogation, like I discussed, or coercing informants to work for you. or just general misrepresentation of facts and law. So we have this question of distribution. And I promise this is the final piece, and then I will stop here before, but I think this is so important, this next piece to what I'm gonna, to sort of the fundamental, sort of the foundation of the series on race and policing. So there's this beautiful article by Tommy Shelby, a philosopher at Harvard, and he argues that sort of the unjust distribution of benefits and burdens should result in a recharacterization of some deviant. So when I say, you know, people, the community breach their end of the social contract, Shelby is arguing that maybe we should recharacterize and reevaluate how we conceive of that deviance in criminality. So deviance is simply this idea of crime and contempt for authority. Shelby focuses on the ghetto, which he means areas defined by race and poverty in inner cities. So, you know, it's really interesting to think that moral standing and authority could certainly be undermined by deception and dishonesty imposed on specific racial and ethnic groups, but not others. And this, again, I think would be a straightforward breach of the social contract, as well as concrete breaches with specific individuals. So if that's the case, it stands to reason that we think about, you know, the ways we characterize deviance, it's going to naturally differ depending on whether, one, we have institutionally just societies, or on the other hand, institutional unjust societies. It's one thing to evaluate deviance and criminality when people's rights are respected, but it's quite another to evaluate that deviance and criminality when rights are routinely abused. So it's not that criminality or deviance is ever going to be good or justified. No one's making that claim. Shelby is certainly not making that claim, and I wouldn't either. On the other hand, you might think plausibly that some deviance and criminality would be a reasonable response, right? When the police dishonestly and preemptively breach their end of the social contract. So that's the recharacterization that I'm talking about. So finally, just to sort of close this out and keep a connection to the idea of deception, dishonesty, policing, and race, policing is certainly much more than the beneficial values connected with security, right? It's a way, it's the ways the police distribute those benefits as well as those burdens. And those burdens often involve tactics relating to deception, dishonesty that can significantly affect one's life. I mean, you look at the Central Park Five case, they spent years in prison, arguably in large part because of these very deceptive and dishonest tactics that were legally justified. So an unjustified distribution of these burdens will certainly affect the trust of the police as well as their legitimacy. And I think the upshot, for me at least, of this analysis is the idea that much of what we see in the police institution, much of the deception and dishonesty that we think might be justified, is actually much more pernicious and much more problematic, because it's much more than thinking about enforcing a law or stopping crime. It's about the larger effects that we're having on society, as well as the deviation from political norms of consent, voluntariness, and treating people as moral agents. So I'm going to pause right there, and that's my book. And I'm going to take the screen share down now, if I can figure this out. Stop share. And happy to chat or answer questions with the time we have.
Great. Thanks so much, Luke. That was really very helpful and fascinating, the way you take your philosophy background and apply it to this question. I actually was a philosophy major in college, so I picked up a lot of that as well. One of the things that it, on a first read, was rather shocking was the discussion around transparency as particularly when talking about law enforcement and government, government transparency, which I always saw as a public good, not just as an agent, but as an advocate afterwards at the ACLU and the Brennan Center. But you raise questions about whether government transparency is always good. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, a lot of philosophers have raised a similar point. And here's the idea. So you might think about transparency as a form of surveillance, right? So let me give you a specific example with the police institution. So a lot of what, say, a police chief has to do involves expert knowledge that people in the public, those watching 30-second news clips at home, have no way of sort of digesting. They're dealing with data, they're dealing with problems, they're dealing with sophisticated software, maybe like algorithmic policing or predictive policing. And if they were to be completely transparent with the public, it would create these situations that would entail a lack of understanding. You would have to try to give reasons that everyone could agree to. And that's just impossible because we're dealing with such complex issues in a soundbite. And so one worry is that by having too much transparency, it might compel police officials to sort of fudge things, right? Only saying things that sound particularly good, selectively choosing certain soundbites. Now, in my view, I think that's actually not a worry we should have. I think given the amount of surveillance the police have on us, it stands to reason that we should hold them to this very high standard, and they just got to figure it out, right? Figure out how to be both transparent and effectively communicate their policies and rationales for doing things. And the reason I think that's so important is because at least if you're concerned with democratic policing, right, the only way to sort of hold the police accountable and to know whether the police are actually conducting their job in good faith is through some degree of transparency, or else we just don't know whether the police are doing things in the way they say they're doing things. So too much transparency arguably can be problematic at some very sophisticated contexts, but I think the benefits of transparency ultimately outweigh the difficulties of being transparent with the public in many cases.
And you know, one of the reasons why I think that's interesting is this notion that transparency compels some dishonesty from the government.
Absolutely.
Which you also talk about in terms of the exclusionary rule, the Map versus Ohio Supreme Court case that said if the government violates the Fourth Amendment, illegally searches your house, they can't use that evidence. That evidence will be excluded from any proceeding. And that compelled in your writing a different kind of lying, government lying, that perhaps is even more pernicious, test lying, you call it.
Right. That's exactly right. And so, you know, this idea that, you know, if you're going to have your evidence excluded, it encourages this concept of test lying. Well, you might lie about the foundation or the basis of the arrest, that you saw them engage in a drug deal or something along those lines, because you don't want to get your evidence excluded. So, for example, if you search someone's house without a warrant, right, you're going to be, that's evidence will be thrown out. On the other hand, if when the door's open, you can make a claim that you saw something happen or something in the house, that'll give you sort of ability to go into the house without a warrant because of, a plain view doctrine. So these are things that you can sort of massage to make sure your evidence doesn't get thrown out. And so I think that's certainly related to transparency. Another interesting way that transparency is important to policing is this, and just to kind of, if people are interested in, I guess, more of the contemporary sort of hot topics and technological policing. So think about predictive policing. Predictive policing suggests that, or it's based on a software program, and basically the software program can predict supposedly where crime will occur, right? So it can be place-based or person-based, but basically the police will get a printout before their shift. And the printout says, look, you should go to this box because statistically a crime is going to occur there according to the algorithm. All right. So suppose the police go to this box and they see someone walking down the street with a hoodie and a bulge in their pocket, and they think they're suspicious. Now, not normally would they stop them? I don't know, but maybe because of that prediction software, the police have this psychological reason and maybe concrete reason to think, hey, crime is predicted to occur here. So I'm going to use that in part as a basis for my reasonable suspicion to stop and frisk this person. Now, why is transparency relevant here? If you ask that police officer why they were in that box, their answer, I can almost assure you, will be, well, because an algorithm told me to, that's based on a mathematical formula that I have no idea why it works or how it works. And I would say the same thing, because I don't understand how those algorithms work either. But if we're policing people based on these algorithms that are essentially black boxes, it stands to reason that we have a better explanation for the public, more transparency about why the police are ending up in this particular neighborhood versus others, rather than just saying, well, the algorithm told me to. That's the essence of opacity and the lack of transparency.
Thanks for that. And the reason why the part on transparency, I think resonated with me so much is because in doing the undercover work, which of course is based on a deception, pretending to be somebody I'm not and lying to the people about the criminal activities I'm supposedly going to help them engage in, how I at least made that okay in my own mind was that there was transparency at the end. That if the government was going to charge them with a crime, the books would be open and the opportunity to look at all the evidence and to test whether my lying was justified by the nature of the crime. Lets a jury of 12 people decide that this is important. And particularly where we see it less existent in the national security context. And you talk about the national security context. Why don't you talk about that? Because one of my concerns has been, and particularly, you know, kind of trying to draw these strings together, that call them suspect communities, whether it's through a predictive algorithm or through bias, the police have determined that one population are the people who are committing crime. So therefore, that's where their resources should focus. That with the secrecy that they demand in national security, that becomes a heightened problem, both historically, you know, targeting the civil rights movement, FBI is targeting the civil rights movement, and recently in targeting the Black Lives Matter movement with surveillance and aggressive sting operations. So can you talk about how the context of national security alters
Well, let me use an example that from our past lives, Mike. So let's talk about the FBI, and I can do this because this is all public information. So if you go onto the FBI's website, you'll see the DIOG, right? Mike, have you read much of the DIOG? Did that come after you left? I don't know.
Yes, it came after. Well, it was being created after I left, but yes, most of it came after I left. There was a MIOG before that, but the DIOG is a very different kind of document.
So basically, roughly, this is the operating manual for FBI investigations, what you can and can't do. And the interesting thing about the DIOG, this document that tells the FBI what they can and can't do, it very clearly stakes out the kind of investigative activity FBI agents can conduct. And there are, I may forget them, you have an assessment, you have a preliminary investigation, you have a full investigation, and you have an enterprise investigation, right? So the interesting thing about that is that an assessment requires no predication. In other words, no basis to engage in investigative activity, right? So that's one flag I want to raise. The other flag I want to raise is it kind of gets worse, right? So even if you don't have an assessment opened, the FBI can engage in inquiries, investigative activities through, for example, databases that it has at its disposal without predication. In other words, basis for an investigation. So why is that a problem or a worry with respect to transparency and national security? Well, if the FBI and other agencies, I don't want to just pick on the FBI, can open up an assessment on various groups or entities without predication, that should give us pause. Moreover, it should certainly give us pause if it can query databases without even an assessment. And how is this relevant to transparency? Well, because we don't even know what databases they have and are using, because that's redacted information. And we don't know what the extent of information that is in those databases. Now, we do know ways that our personal information can end up there. And that's based largely on this idea of the third party doctrine. So anytime we use our phone or use any third party, you know, we have us, a third party, and the police, and we give that information voluntarily, I'm going to put it in quotes, to a third party, the government, the state, can get that information without a search warrant, right? So if I tell something to Bob and Bob tells it to the police don't need a search warrant to get it from Bob. In the same way, if I give something to the phone company gives it to the police don't need a warrant. So there's this huge, in my view, significant degree of opacity with respect to both the data being used by national security organizations, including the FBI, who's also a law enforcement agency, as well as transparent or lack of transparency with respect to when they're going to query that information, specifically in cases when there's no basis to open an investigation, such as an assessment or a pre-assessment. So certainly there's a need to do these things in high level cases, but my position would be in all cases, you need predication. You need a basis to engage in sort of sifting through people's lives. And that's a function of transparency, I think.
Yeah, and I think the lack of transparency, because it sort of turned things upside down, where in the first 2 years the FBI had this authority, they conducted 80,000 assessments, according to their own records, which doesn't maybe sound like a whole lot, except there are 12,000 FBI agents. It gives you an idea of how much of the investigative resources are going towards investigations where there's no basis to believe anyone has done anything wrong. Right. And particularly with the history of bias, who gets targeted in those investigations is critical to understanding the rest of the FBI's investigations. You know,
absolutely.
We used to have a saying when I was in the FBI, I'm not sure if it's the same when you were there, that nobody's administratively pure.
That's right.
That if you look hard enough, you'll find something that somebody did wrong. And unfortunately, what we see in a lot of these cases, and a particular type of another element that changed in the FBI is the way the FBI approaches undercover sting operations, whether they're using an informant or an FBI undercover agent. And you mentioned the case of James Cromedy, which is peculiar and different from the types of cases that I worked, because there was no underlying crime.
Right.
But why don't you tell us a little bit about that case?
Yeah. So the Cromedy case, fascinating case. I think there's been a documentary made about it, an HBO documentary. And this was, what was the name of this case? The Newburgh Four? Is that what the name of, I believe it was?
Yeah, the Newburgh Four. The documentary is the Newburgh Sting.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is a case in the years after 9/11, and this is not uncommon. The FBI and law enforcement in general were, of course, interested in stopping terrorist attacks. And one way they did that was to task informants, typically like the example I gave with the drug informant. The FBI would have leverage over these people, of course. And in this Cromedy case, the police had a man with the head leverage over, and they said, look, we want you to go into areas in which there's Islamic communities, mosques, and so on, and we want you to see if you can find people who are, you know, angry with the United States, who wish ill will on people in the United States. And that's exactly what this informant did. He found this man, Cromedy, who had they had some mutual connections, I believe in Afghanistan or Pakistan, I don't remember exactly where. And basically, this guy said, yeah, I'd like to do something bad to the United States after they got this conversation going. I'd like to die a martyr. And the interesting thing about Cromedy in particular is that he was this guy who's very low-level criminal. He got by, he subsisted on basically petty drug sale and distribution. He worked at Walmart, and he was basically living below the poverty line. I think he made like $14,000 a year, something like that. And over the course of many, many, many months, the FBI and this informant, in my words, compelled Cromedy to go along with this plot to engage in a terrorist attack. And indeed, all of the sort of the central points of the plot were all constructed by either the FBI or the informant, and oftentimes the FBI, who would guide the informant to say, look, here are the kinds of targets that would work. And by the way, we're going to supply you, Cromedy, with every resource you need, whether that's surveillance cameras for surveillance, whether it's literal rockets to blow things up. And we're talking about a guy here who has basically incompetent in terms of doing anything maybe above buying like selling like $100 worth of drugs or something like that, or, you know. And ultimately, after this highly constructed activity, the police, the FBI, of course, arrest Cromedy along with others he recruited. And the four of them are charged with various federal crimes and are sentenced to, I think, upwards of 20 years in prison. And they served most of that time. But just recently, I think three, not yet Cromedy, I don't think yet, were released on grounds of what's the phrase?
Compassionate release.
Compassionate release. And this is basically because of this very heavy-handed use of deception and dishonesty. And I'll pause there because I've maybe explained the case not briefly enough. But the worry you have here are obvious. So one, there's a construction of crime based on deception and dishonesty. And the other thing is this: sure, counterterrorism cases are very important, and sometimes it might call for deception and dishonesty, but the standards need to be much higher. Namely, in my view, and we don't have time to get into this, when there is an acute risk of harm. And in this particular case, I can't find any evidence that there was an acute risk of harm, that anybody involved had the capability of doing anything wrong to anyone. So that's one of the worries here. And the other worry, just to bring this back to undercover work more broadly, and Mike, I know you can speak to this much better than I can because I did not serve as an undercover agent. But the worry I have is this. You know, a lot of the undercover operations we see, and I'm not just talking about the FBI, I'm talking maybe more about state and local police. A lot of it historically, and maybe that's going away a little bit, was drug cases, right? So we have drug buys, firearms, purchases, buy bust sorts of things. And this is pervasive. And I think, you know, the fact that we permit the police to engage in this sort of activity that would otherwise be illegal, the FBI calls it otherwise illegal activity, but also that we instill in the community that this sort of deception and dishonesty is pervasive and you can't trust anybody. They may be an undercover officer, they may be an informant, sort of erodes both the rule of law and community trust. So my point would be, look, if we're going to use undercover operations and this sort of very deceptive constructed police work, it needs to be for those cases where we have that high level interest, where there's that acute threat that makes it actually necessary to prevent some sort of significant harm, not this vast deception, dishonesty that we see sort of willy-nilly every day. I know my answers are way too long. Yeah. I apologize for that.
No, I totally agree. Mary, go ahead. Oh, you're still on mute, Mary.
Yeah, I won't take too much time because we're quickly running out of time. And I want to thank you, Luke, for that wonderful presentation. But you bring up some issues that have, you know, intrigued me, I guess. What you described with the Sting case sounds like entrapment, but is it called entrapment at the federal level?
Or? So it could be, but in that particular case, the legal standard for entrapment was not met, right? So, and I think I'll pause there and say, yes, there is a potential for entrapment, but the defense did not meet that burden to establish entrapment. But I agree with you. That either suggests that, well, one, they got it wrong, or two, we need to reevaluate our entrapment standard. And I do have things to say about that, but I'll pause there. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it reminded me so much of all of the stuff I've read on COINTELPRO, because those were the same tactics that were, you know, it sounds like the same tactics that were used against groups like the Black Panther Party, and then even earlier, the Back to Africa movement, you know, that Hoover initiated. But so does that still exist? Do you know? COINTELPRO?
So, I mean, we
should probably say, we should probably say what COINTELPRO is first.
Yeah.
And then maybe you want me to, or do you want to? Go ahead.
Well, so you're referring to in the 60s, 70s, the FBI's extensive surveillance of people like Martin Luther King Jr., various abuses of surveillance authority, which ultimately led to more stringent legal frameworks like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, those sorts of things. But if you want to add to that, or you probably are more versed in that, but that's roughly, it's an extensive abuse of surveillance discretion on groups that it seems that there's sort of a political ideological disagreement with the basis of the surveillance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So do you know if it still exists, or did it ever formally get disbanded, or?
Yeah, I think after that was the Church Committee, right?
Yes.
Disbanded those sorts of activities and required that when the FBI, for example, or other intelligence and law enforcement agencies want to engage in, say, wiretaps, even if involved in national security cases or foreign intelligence, for example, they have to go through a particular kind of framework. And we have this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act framework that guides the FBI, along with other, you know, institutions, on how we can wiretap people legally, but at the same time without a search warrant. Mm-hmm. So it has been addressed, right? But that doesn't mean that all of the ways that we conduct surveillance today are justified. It just means that we have addressed that specific piece of it, I guess would be my answer.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah. And the new rules that Luke operated under the FBI were changed post 9/11. Basically, what the result of the Church Committee investigation was a requirement of criminal predicates for the FBI to do investigations. They had to have a reasonable indication that somebody was committing a crime in order to justify an investigation. And those predicates, as he mentioned, were taken away after 9/11 in the new rules that the FBI operates under. So while COINTELPRO doesn't exist as a program anymore, the same types of activities targeting protesters, environmentalists, and other groups are allowed to occur because the rules have been loosened once again. And Luke writes a bit about FISA and problems with that system in the book as well. In fact, I don't know if Matt or Robbie, you have questions?
I just had a quick question. Luke, thank you very much for that wonderful presentation. Right before you joined the meeting, Mike, Jeremy, and Matt and I were talking about the Reed interrogation technique. And there is an article I read recently in which this detective Well, according to the author, a detective was interviewing a gentleman who had killed his wife, and the detective was practicing this technique called minimization.
Yeah.
He said that, you know, I understand, you know, relationships can be very volatile. And, you know, last week, you know, I was having an argument with my wife, and if the phone hadn't rung, I'm not sure what I would have done to try to get the gentleman to confess. So what are your thoughts on that technique, the Reed technique?
Right. We should clarify that that wasn't you, Robbie, right?
Of course not.
With the telephone. And, okay. All right.
Yeah. So this is a fascinating question. And I think there's been a decent amount of research and psychology research on this. And my takeaway from what I understand the literature to be is that the Reed technique is very good at eliciting confessions, but not necessarily good at getting confessions that are true, right? So, and you might think, well, why would someone who's innocent ever confess? And, you know, there are lots of reasons for this. So you think about what you just described, this minimization technique, and you think about, it's all based on, you know, psychology and getting the position in the person in a position in which they're comfortable talking, minimize what they did, and so on. If we just use the Central Park Five case as an example, but it doesn't have to be that, it could be many others. When people have been in a room for many, many hours, they're made to believe that if they get this over with, it's not that big of a deal. We can go back to normal. And here's where it gets tricky. Not only are you going through, say, the Reed technique, but also you bring in a box, and the box is supposedly full of damning evidence that the police have against you. And that's a complete prop, right? So you don't know what they're talking about, but they got this box, right? And yeah, it can be rational to hedge, especially if you're someone who maybe doesn't have great counsel, or someone who's, you know, not particularly adept at navigating your rights and so on. It can be rational to confess. So I think the Reed technique, while it may be effective, it overlooks the fact that we're not just trying to find, you know, get a conviction. We're trying to actually know the truth about who did the crime, right? And my worry has been more about that piece that I just mentioned, the use of material misrepresentation in conjunction with, say, the Reed technique. So giving someone facts that are just not true. Someone said you did this, we've got them saying it, you better come clean, and that's a lie. Or saying, hey, what you did, if you did this, is not murder, it's at best manslaughter or something like that. Or what you did is not sexual assault if you consented to it, it's okay if there was consent involved here. When come to find out, you have something like, this really does meet the requirements of murder or sexual assault or whatever. So these misrepresentations of fact and law in conjunction with the Reed technique, I find to be particularly troubling. But I Reed technique, it's a big can of worms we could go into for sure.
Thank you, Luke.
Real quick, just to end on an anecdote that I heard about recently. A man was his wife was beaten badly, and she eventually died, but didn't die until she got to the hospital. So they're interrogating him, and they said, your wife's coming to now. And she said, you did it. And so the guy was still claiming that he was innocent. He was saying, well, maybe I blacked out or something, because it can influence, as you're suggesting, it can influence the innocent too.
Sure.
You know, maybe I blacked out, or, you know, I don't remember. But if she says, you know, just like with the Central Park Five. So it can be, I've seen interrogations that have lasted hours and hours. I was a cop in LA for 18 years, and I've seen them last hours and hours and hours, and people are just, you know, they're ready to send their mom to prison.
That's right. And then the one last thing I'll say on that point very quickly. So you might say, well, what about the cases in which the person really did do it? Maybe it's okay to lie to them then. And the response I would say there is this: well, look, you know, if we care about rights and we care about, say, the right to remain silent, you can't respect that right if you're basing that confession on basically a fraudulent interaction. So to say that someone can voluntarily confess when they've been, you know, given a material misrepresentation about their legal situation or the facts against them cuts against the whole idea of having a right, including a right to remain silent. So, you know, if we care about rights, even rights for those people who did something wrong, then these sorts of tactics need to be reevaluated and revisited.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Luke. I see we've run out of time, but there's one comment. It's less of a question than a comment in the Q&A that I think goes to a lot of what you write. So I'll just read it so the audience can hear. When the flow of information is controlled by a single entity of governing bodies that benefit from a curated narrative, the public will always be forbidden from understanding or having access to the fuller picture. They are intentionally kept ignorant. Society needs disclosure in order to make informed decisions regarding legislation, social advocacy. I think that the issues of brutality, excessive force that occur in prisons across the nation at the hands of correctional staff and how these instances are explained away if documented, there is an almost zero transparency regarding what goes on inside institutions. This lack of transparency only further exacerbates ignorance, creating a disconnect between those inside and those outside. Controlling the flow of information, whether through deception or otherwise, will always feel like a strategic maneuver to conceal the truth. Powerful people and groups benefit from complacency, and that's from Corinne. But I know that you talk about that quite a bit in the book.
Very, very well said. Yeah, it's really been a pleasure to chat with you all. Thank you for the fantastic questions and just the opportunity to come on and share my views with it on this topic.
Thanks,
Luke. Okay, well, good luck with the book.
Thank you very
hopefully
much.
We can have you back again for your next one.
I'd love to. Yeah, y'all have a great rest of your day. Bye-bye.
Thanks.